Elections will come to order. There is not a quorum present yet, but we will start with Senator Carlson's bill, Senate File 1394, just because he's the one listed first on the agenda who's here. So, Senator Carlson, Senate File 1394, all the bills on the agenda today are for discussion purposes only. But if you'd like to present Senate File 1394.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Another packed house. This is the plan to move primary elections to June. And as you said, this is an informational hearing, so I'm not going to spend very much time speaking about it. I have Mr. Gary Goldsmith here from the Campaign Finance Board. But just to go through some simple things, it's going to move the primary election date to the first Tuesday after the third Monday in June for state and local primary elections. It states that the state primary will be held on the first Tuesday after the third Monday in June in each even-numbered year. It states the regular state primary will be held on the first Tuesday after the third Monday in June of odd-numbered years. And Section 7 and 10 state that the municipal and school district primaries will be held on the first Tuesday after the third Monday in June. As you can probably imagine, there are some positives and some negatives of this. And there are some things that Mr. Goldsmith will describe, because when you move these dates so early, they do affect other things that happen on the calendar, and especially the reporting dates that we have. So with that, I'll sit aside here and have Mr. Goldsmith describe the bill to you.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Mr. Goldsmith, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. And actually, I'm not going to describe the bill because the board has no particular position on this bill, and it's not a board bill. But I have reviewed it for implications for Chapter 10A, which the Campaign Finance Board does administer. And a couple of years ago, the legislature increased the number of reports to be filed by certain reporting entities, and in particular those are statewide candidates and the caucuses of the political parties, as well as the state party unit of the political parties. And the first two reports, which cover the first 3 months and then the first 5 months, are date specific, so they're always due on the same date. Then we get to reports that are driven by the date of the primary, and they're backed up a certain number of days from the primary or general election. And so by providing for an earlier primary election, the pre-primary report would be due earlier, and for a June primary, it turns out that the five-month report and the pre-primary report would be due within a week or two of each other, depending on exactly when the primary falls. I won't speak when you talk about the March primary bill, but we would have similar issues. So what the board will propose, should this bill move forward either as part of an omnibus bill or on its own, I have worked with the author and will continue to work with the author and Senate counsel to provide an improved schedule for those reports. Essentially, what it would do would be take out the five-month report, and that would be the new pre-primary election report. What is currently a five-month report would come later and would come about where the pre-primary now comes. Again, this is just for those people and party units that are already required to file six reports, and so the effect would be to keep the reporting schedule essentially the same. We did notice a couple of other things that will need to be looked at. One is economic interest filings. As you know, candidates must file a statement of economic interest once they file to run for office. They're also required to file one on April 15th. It'll be mandatory if the board's technical recommendations bill passes. And moving the primary election up will make those statements come in fairly close proximity to each other. I think that the board would recommend, but I will certainly propose to the author language that would make it would facilitate candidates not having to file two economic interest statements within close proximity to each other. One other thing that was brought to my attention and doesn't particularly relate to this bill except for the fact that we would be changing reporting dates, and that is that when the legislature did put in the 6 reports per election year for caucuses and state party units, as well as all PACs and statewide candidates, what we didn't think about was that the Senate caucus party unit doesn't really do anything differently in an election year when the House is on the ballot and the Senate is not than it would otherwise. And so requiring them to file 6 reports during that particular year it seems to be unnecessary and not provide a public benefit, whereas it does require some additional work by them and by the board. So if report dates are being adjusted, it would be probably appropriate to look at removing that particular reporting requirement for the Senate caucus party units.
And Mr. Goldsmith, will you just remind me, if this bill should become law, are those report dates set in statute, or do you just adjust them accordingly?
Madam Chair, that's why I'm here, because they are in statute. The first 2 are fixed dates, and the others are driven by the primary date, so they would automatically adjust. It's the fixed date ones that the legislature would have to adjust. And in particular, it's the 5-month date. I looked at at 2016, the pre-primary election report, which is driven by the date of the primary, would be due June 6th, and the 5-month report, which is a fixed date, is due June 14th. So that's the example of the problem.
So, Mr. Goldsmith, if this bill moves forward, then that language would need to be amended into the bill.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I have nothing else unless members have questions.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
I believe Madam Chair, we have the Secretary of State who is going to make some comments.
Mr. Secretary, do you want to provide your comments? Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate your time and allowing me to say a few words on this bill. I know this is an informational hearing, but it's an issue that I think is of great concern to a lot of people. I was heavily involved in the 2009 effort to move our then September primary to August. I was the chief author in the House, where I then served. And the rationale at the time, as many who were there remember, was to help further accommodate overseas Minnesotans, primarily but not only military members. Of course, it includes diplomats, students, business people, and others, but primarily military. And there was a lot of pressure on us to do that, and we did it, and it was the right thing to do. At the time, I personally wanted a June primary. That was the date that I thought made the most sense. Governor Plenty was governor then. He thought August was probably the best fit to at least try for a while, and so August it was. After 3 statewide primary elections with August, 2010, 2012, 2014, things have no doubt gotten easier for overseas military folks. They could be even better, but it's gotten a lot easier. But there's one glaring problem with the August primary, and that is turnout. I've asked the question before, what if we held an election and no one showed up? We came, you know, somewhat close to that. I'm kidding, of course, but this last year. And what's interesting about that is we can't claim, as we could in other years, that there was no excitement on the ballot. I mean, in the Republican Party, there was an exciting and close gubernatorial contest. And on the DFL side, there was an exciting and close, well, not as close, I suppose, but certainly exciting and interesting auditors contest. So we can't claim that there was no drama. There was plenty of drama. And yet, turnout was 10%. And I don't think that's any way to run an election or any place to have an election. So despite this, there was 10% turnout, which is interesting because we know that as Minnesotans, we're doers, we're joiners, and we're voters. And we routinely vote at the very top of the list in terms of turnout in the general election, so we know what we're capable of. It's not as if we don't have a culture of participation. We do, and yet to have participation sink so low to the 10% range really says something. And to me, what it says, anyway, is that we're having an election at a time when we shouldn't have an election. August is a time where Minnesotans are trying to squeeze the last few drops out of summer. They're out on the lake, they're biking, they're walking, they're vacationing, they're maybe out of the state altogether. And so it makes sense to have it some other time. I think in July you'd get to much the same problem. June, while certainly not perfect, seems like the next best place so that we'd have turnout and yet be able to really accommodate everyone.
Mr. Secretary, can I interrupt you?
Yes.
Just to that point, though, it seems like the third Monday in June, as this bill proposes, is still well into summer. I mean, schools have let out by then. Families are on vacation. Kids are enrolled in camp. Parents are vacationing. How do you differentiate between the third week in June? I mean, if it was the early June where some schools are still in, I could see the difference. But This is well into summer, as is the August date. What's the difference?
Right. Well, to be honest, I mean, I think June is more important to me than when it is. And, you know, I agree. By that measure, earlier would probably be better. And that's really up to the authors and the House and Senate to decide that. So to me, the earlier the better, generally. So I agree with the general sentiment there. But I think moving it from August, I think, is the important thing. I think July, you'd get much the same problem. And if, you know, in the opinion of the authors, something earlier in June would be to their liking and, then more importantly, to other members' liking, you know, I think our office would be behind that change.
But Mr. Really Secretary, one other question, then I'll let you proceed with your testimony. Why is moving it to a Monday a good idea versus a traditional voting days are on Tuesday? I'm sorry. It's the first Tuesday after the third Monday. I just read it wrong. Sorry.
Well, Madam Chair, I would say this. Generally speaking, too, when it comes to kind of how you segment the election season, I think that Minnesotans should be spending more of the election season talking about who the best candidate for office is and less of the election system talking about who the best Democrat is or who the best Republican is for a particular office. And right now, even with August, we're spending, you know, under 3 months talking about who the best, I'll just pick one office, state auditor is, and we're spending a year or more talking about who the best DFL candidate for auditor is or who the best Republican or Independence Party or Green or Libertarian Party is. I think more of the segment, the larger part of the electoral segment should be about just who the best office holder is. And I think all parties, frankly, would appreciate early unity rather than later unity in that context, too. I want to say a word, though, about those who administer our elections at the local level, the counties in most cases, but in also some cases cities. And I would favor at some point, either today or at some point down the line, an accommodation for them. I'm sensitive to their very real concerns, particularly in greater Minnesota and particularly among smaller counties, about the fact that auditors and auditor treasurers often wear multiple hats. One of those hats is property tax administration, and one, of course, is election administration. And those two might come in conflict to some extent. There might be some overlap with an earlier primary date. For that reason, our office and I would support an effective date that is further out, perhaps 2018, maybe even later, so that they can be accommodated and maybe make arrangements, staffing arrangements that would accommodate this new schedule. One other criticism I guess I'd like to raise and preempt, I suppose, and it's one that members tend not to make out loud for reasons that I understand, but having carried this bill before in the legislature, believe me, I heard them loudly and clearly in private. Some legislators say privately, particularly rural or greater Minnesota legislators, they're concerned, and this is my words, not theirs, that, you know, some whippersnapper is going to go and primary them while they're stuck in St. Paul until the third week in May. But I have to say, you look at other states, particularly Iowa. Iowa has a January to May legislative schedule, just like we do, and they have a June primary, like this bill proposes to do. And if you look at the results in Iowa, cycle after cycle after cycle, there is hardly ever any meaningful primary challenge. Now, is it possible? Yes, it absolutely is. Is it likely? Probably not. And I would argue that members in rural communities in greater Minnesota, you know, during the session, they're also in the news more, with daily and weekly newspapers and radio and TV that also cover them. So I don't think there is, at least it's easy for me to say I was not a rural legislator, obviously, but I think when you look at other states and their experience, it just hasn't been the case. So I don't think this would extend the political season. It would just extend the portion of the existing political season that has us spending time on who the best candidate is, not just who the best Democrat or who the best Republican is. And I think in the end, it's about the voters. It's not about anyone who holds office. It's about the voters and whether we should be having an election at a time when more voters can actually participate. And I think that's what this would do. And we know that Minnesotans, at a time when it's convenient for them, we know what they can and will do. They will participate, they will show up, and they will vote. And that's what I'm confident this would do if we were to move the primary earlier and away from August. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think for a while, having dealt with this whole language thing with primaries, the purpose of a primary is for political parties to narrow their choice to one. The success of that is if they narrow it to one. And if that is their candidate and it goes to the ballot, and it's up to them within their political party to work that all out. And sometimes the heat of the contest is not as sharp within the parties as you would have thought, maybe, or maybe they feel both are good enough so that they're okay either way. I think summer is summer, but I think I'm more concerned about the actual language here and how everything is going to kind of work out. I'm still up in the air about it all. But I would like to, if we're taking a look at this, it's a nomination, and if I was taking a quick look through the language, and it calls it nomination, nomination, nomination. It's not an election because nobody takes office because of a result of a primary. It's a narrowing of the choices, whether it's a nonpartisan, local one, or within a political party. And words mean things, and people have expectations after a while of an election, especially where we look for high voter turnout and we look for that high participation. But this is a unique kind of a thing, and I wouldn't even call it an election because it's a nomination and helping people to understand its purpose. But it's an open nomination so that anybody can participate. It's not many states have that. So I just think that when we talk about it as an election with the same judgments about voter turnout as what we might talk about on the general election, I don't know. And I think we always work for it, but you look back historically over the results of primaries, they're just all over the place. And they're just a unique function of the process and may have its value. Some people would like to do it differently, but it is what it is. So, but the big thing is that it's a nomination. And it should be. We should look at its success within that context and not judge our folks too harshly about the turnout issue. That's just my concern.
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that, Senator Kiffmeyer. It is worth noting, as you did, that this is really an intra-party affair, although the difference here is that they're enlisting the state and, you know, tax dollars in order to do mm-hmm. their winnowing. And that's why we're all involved. I should have mentioned, too, that both of the major remaining political parties in Minnesota, their leadership supports this, has for a long time. In fact, a few years ago, I remember there was a press conference at which the heads of four major parties, the DFL, the Republican, the Libertarian, and the Green Party, all showed up at the press conference announcing their support for a June primary. I assume it's the same with all four major parties. I know with all four of those parties, but with the two major parties, I know the leadership there does support this legislation.
Madam Chair, rather, in regards to that, I thought of before, all the money we go through and the state resources we go through, we could just have the parties nominate their candidate, put them on the ballot, and skip the other expensive process, because it is quite expensive to do that. It's just an interesting frame of thought, but every time somebody talks about doing it that way, then it's like, no, 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 now we're okay, even if we do spend that money. So I think there's always a balance to that, but I think calling it a nomination and rather than an election might help to have a clearer understanding of what it truly, really, in fact, is.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. We appreciate your testimony. Are there other people in the audience who wish to testify on this matter? Ms. Erickson, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Debbie Erickson. I'm the Crow Wing County Auditor Treasurer, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers as the chair of the Elections Committee. As Secretary Simon noted, there are some differing opinions throughout the state with regard to my colleagues with regard to the June primary date and earlier primary. As he noted, most auditors in the greater Minnesota area do have multiple duties that they are responsible for and in cases do not necessarily have dedicated election staff who can handle simply that task. Rather, they're also dealing with tax calculation finances, many other things that come before our office. With that said, we have had some conversations with our members, and with the understanding that there is an interest in pushing the primary forward into the year, we are acceptable with the June date with the hope that there is a possibility of looking at pushing it out to 2018. 2016, while doable, would create a couple of issues. We would like to have the opportunity for those counties who do feel that there would be some additional costs and burdens to be able to better quantify what that information is and share that information with their county commissioners and go through that process once before that. Additionally, we have several counties who are currently in the process of purchasing and implementing new election equipment, and if we were to move the primary to June in 2016, that could interfere with some of that process from the standpoint of receiving acceptance testing and testing of equipment early enough in the season. Finally, the last issue that we were seeing with the earlier primary is, in a lot of cases, our election judge core base that we are pulling from are oftentimes are some of our seasonal population. So by giving us a little bit extra time to communicate with them and prepare them for that hope, maybe we can get them to come back a little bit earlier so we can do a little earlier training in the year. But we think that we could communicate that and still be able to make that happen. So we would encourage a possible effective date of 2018 if possible.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Is there, I know that this similar bill is moving forward in the House. Have you had a chance to see if there is a fiscal note attached to that because of the local impact on, I can get
Madam
that
Chair,
information.
Madam Chair, I don't believe that we have put any information forward for that, and I haven't seen one if there is.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Sulem, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And as an association, we do not have a stance on whether March, June, or August is the best month for a primary. I'm simply here to let you know, with June, we too would encourage a pushback to at least 2018. Currently, we provide election officer training, 2 hours of the election officials training, at our June seminars. We will not be able to do that, obviously, if the primary moves back to June. And so we're going to need to coordinate with the county how to accommodate the additional training that will have to occur to make up for the loss of our workshops. And quite frankly, our association will probably need to maybe shift some of our dates so we don't end up having a day where all of our officers are running a primary and unable to attend. So because of all the coordination that would need to occur, we would also support a 2018 delay.
Thank you. Ms. Kelleher, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I didn't have a chance to talk to Senator Carlson earlier. I apologize. But MSBA has had a longstanding position on primaries, trying to keep them as close to the November election as possible. We really find it difficult to find candidates in outstate Minnesota when it gets too far away. Parents just aren't – they're thinking about getting out of school. They aren't thinking about getting into school. So I just wanted to be on the record talking about that concern as we go forward. And some of the issues we're having. So thank you, Madam Chairman. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kelleher, in regards to that, since this is a primary, that issue is one of filing, right? Filing is the issue more so than the fact, because if you don't have, if you don't have a certain quantity, you don't have to do the primary at all. So this, but the main issue is that no matter that, it's the filing deadline.
Madam Chairman and Senator Kiffmeyer, you are right on the money. That's exactly when. And it just gets so disjointed for folks, even when there isn't a primary, because the filing's so early. So just appreciate that being in your thoughts. So thank you.
Anybody else who wishes to speak on this matter? So thank you very much, Senator Carlson. We appreciate you presenting the bill at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The next bill on our agenda then is Senator Newman, Senate File 327. Welcome back to the Elections Committee, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're a long ways away. This almost looks like a cartoon. It's nice to be back. Thank you very much. And I'm sure I'll see you in judiciary in the not-too-distant future.
That's right.
Madam Chair, members, I do want to go through the bill and some information for you, but I did want to bring to your attention that I did have an amendment drafted, and I would, with your permission, want to offer that so I could put the bill in the form that I want it to be for purposes of this discussion.
So we'll have that amendment distributed then.
Yeah, and specifically, thank you, Madam Chair, it's the A4 amendment that I wish to use. There may be a couple of them there, but I think we'll just go with the A4 for purposes of this hearing. I have now been educated, Madam Chair. Thank you. And we are going to go with the A3 amendment.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, the A3 amendment does a couple of things. First of all, in line 1.3, makes reference to 211B.22, and the purpose of that is to remove any jurisdiction from the Campaign Finance Disclosure Board and move this issue over to the Office of Administrative Hearings. The other portion of the bill deals with, beginning on line 1.9, for ballot questions other than constitutional amendments, and addresses the prohibition applying to local units of government, and there was some confusion in the original bill. So those are the two differences in the A3 amendment as opposed to the Senate File 327 as introduced.
So, Senator Newman, do you want to discuss the entirety of the legislation then, your rationale?
Just as
it?
A suggestion, Madam Chair, what I'd like to do is move and incorporate or have someone move the A3 for me and incorporate it, and then I wanted to discuss the bill as amended.
Okay. So counsel suggests that even though this bill is just for discussion purposes, we could move the A3 amendment to get the shape in the bill that you would like, Senator Newman.
I would appreciate that.
So Senator Carlson moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. The motion prevails. So the language as amended.
Madam Chair, thank you, members. What I would like to do is, for purposes of outlining where this bill has come from, I believe that you have in your packet a letter from Mr. Nobles from the Office of Legislative Auditor dated January 23, 2013. And what I'm going to do is go through that letter in order to provide you some background as to why this bill was generated. And before I start, I want to tell you that back in October of 2012, I and former Senator Perry had approached Mr. Nobles with respect to a question of the former Secretary of State using state assets for purposes of defeating or promoting a ballot initiative. Now, the ballot initiative was the photo ID bill. That was the one that I was primarily concerned with, and it was the former Secretary of State's actions that brought it to my attention. And I specifically mention that, members, because I want you to understand that I am not bringing this bill forward for political partisan reasons, even though that particular constitutional amendment did turn out to be partisan, and I acknowledge that. But rather, I have to use that particular amendment as the reason why I contacted Mr. Nobles in the first place. So it is not my intention to approach this matter in a partisan political matter in any respect. I am approaching this bill from the standpoint that I think it represents good government. If you look on the bottom of page one of Mr. Nobles' letter, he indicates that the scope of his inquiry is going to be, and then on the top of page two, he's going to look into the inquiry regarding allegations of improper use of public money or other resources, and that's for the purpose of either promoting or defeating a ballot question. And in particular, then, on the middle of page two, he goes through his conclusions and recommendations in a summary file or in a summary manner, and I think that's important for you to take a look at. Because what he says there is that Minnesota state law does not establish a clear standard for determining whether it would be legal or illegal for a state official to use public money for the purposes of promoting or opposing a state constitutional amendment. In other words, we've got an ambiguity in state law when it comes to that question. Mr. Nobles then goes on to make some suggestions that if the legislature decides that they want to address this, that we should address the question of whether an elected official should be able to promote or defeat a constitutional amendment or a ballot initiative and address it both from before the ballot initiative is passed and then once it's on the ballot, what kind of circumstances should we allow the elected official to weigh in. So that's sort of the outline of the question that Mr. Nobles addressed and what his recommendations were in very summary form. He then goes on in pages, I believe it's page, if you look at the top left-hand corner, that's where he's got his page numbers. That's page 2, 3, 4, 5, and at the bottom of page 5, he then gets back to the summary, and you can read the letter, on your own terms. But it's his summary that I want to bring your attention to. And there, at the bottom of the letter, he says that in summary, there's a general expectation that public officials may not use public money or other public resources for certain political activities. And then on the top of page 6, he goes in to talk about the ambiguity that we currently have in Minnesota law regarding this issue. He then, in terms of standards for local governments, now he has gone from a constitutional amendment to a ballot question at the local level. And these would be ballot questions, for instance, school board initiatives that are put on the board and the voters are asked to either pass or reject a ballot initiative for, say, a school bond referendum. And he goes on to say that insofar as these standards for local elections, as opposed to the state constitutional ballots, that the Attorney General has issued opinions in the past that local units of government, such as school districts, may not use public money or other public resources to promote the approval of a referendum. Now, that's in Attorney General's opinions. The discussion then goes on where the Minnesota Supreme Court weighs in, and this is at the bottom in the case of Abramson versus St. Louis County School District. And in that case, the court did not decide on this issue and recognized that there is an ambiguity that exists and says there is no statute or case law in Minnesota that authorizes or prohibits a district from advocating one side of the ballot issue. So we've got the Attorney General weighing on one side and the Supreme Court weighing in on the other. Go to page 7 of Mr. Noble's letter. There he looks towards guidance from other states. So Mr. Nobles has now come to the conclusion that we've got an ambiguity in state law, both with respect to ballot questions at the local level and constitutional ballot questions. And so because Minnesota law is unclear on this issue, he goes to foreign jurisdictions to try and resolve the issue and see what they have done. And in summary, when you read the guidance from other states, what he is seeing developed in other states is that it is okay to lobby for a proposed ballot question, so long as it is a proposed ballot question, and other local units of government, local officials, can weigh in and debate freely whether or not a ballot question should be put on the ballot for the voters to vote on. But once that has occurred, then the locally elected official should not use public money, should not use state resources in order to either promote or defeat that ballot question. And in specifically in California, their Supreme Court has addressed this issue that has not been addressed in Minnesota. And in California, their Supreme Court said, no, locally elected officials or elected officials should not use public money to influence the outcome of a ballot initiative. And specifically what they said was that the fundamental precept of this nation's democratic electoral process is that the government may not take sides in election contests and bestow an unfair advantage on one of several competing factions. The court went on to say that the selective use of public funds in election campaigns raises the specter and improper distortion of the democratic electoral process. So here we have got some pretty strong language coming out of a Supreme Court that has looked at this issue and decided that we should not allow elected officials to use taxpayer money to influence the outcome of a ballot initiative. I would invite you on page 8 of Mr. Noble's letter, right in the middle of the paragraphs. These are cites from the court where the court is talking about the use of public money, and it says the use of public treasury to mount an election campaign which attempts to influence the resolution of issues which our Constitution leave to the free election of people does present a serious threat to the integrity of the electoral process. That's really the thing that I'm trying to get at here, is that the impropriety of allowing election officials to use their office and the taxpayer money and taxpayer resources to affect the outcome of a ballot initiative or affect the outcome of a local ballot initiative or referendum. And it just seems to me, Madam Chair and members, that this bill is all about good government and has nothing to do whatsoever in my mind with any type of partisan politics. Now, as to the bill itself, pretty straightforward, and Section 1 addresses the Secretary of State, and Section 2 addresses everybody else in terms of elected officials, insofar as the Secretary of State's office is concerned. I believe that the Secretary of State, as an elected official in the state of Minnesota, is different than anybody else. And the Secretary of State's job is to implement the election laws that the legislature passes. And the Secretary of State's job is to, of course, provide the legislature with information on whether or not the facts that are needed in an election bill. But I don't believe that the Secretary of State should be taking sides on a ballot initiative, because that is the office that handles those ballot initiatives. I don't think the Secretary of State should be involved at any time. And that's what Section 1 says. Section 2 then talks about other candidates and other elected offices. And there we're going to draw a distinction. Elected officers, candidates, we can talk about a ballot initiative and lobby for or against it before it is passed and before it's on the ballot, and I think that's appropriate. But once it's on the ballot, once it is before the taxpayers, then I think it would be improper for elected officials and candidates to address and use public funds for that purpose. I also did want to mention that insofar as the local ballot questions are concerned, where I live, school bonding referendums are really a big deal. And I'm sure that they are in your districts also. But out where I live, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of agricultural lands. And when a ballot initiative comes up, it is always the farm community versus the municipal communities. It always is. And the farmers are continually complaining about the fact that in a local bonding referendum, an unfair amount of the cost to build that new school is falling on their shoulders because they own most of the land. And so they complain about the fact that the local school boards and locally elected officials will use taxpayer money that they have paid, in order to support the bond referendum. And it happens in my district. And I think that is incorrect. And
Senator Senator Newman, before you get too much further along in your testimony about this subject, I think it's fair to allow the School Board Association to provide testimony, because I think what you're saying is contrary to state law right now.
And I would have absolutely no objection if I am joined at the table. I understand that it is against state law, and I'd be willing to bet that they are going to say it doesn't happen. But the fact of the matter is that I have got constituents, and the reason why I have included it in this bill is I have got constituents that are very concerned about that very fact. So I have, like I say, I have certainly no objection to the School Boards Association making any kind of comment on this. And that is the bill, but that is the bill in a nutshell. And I just believe, Madam Chair, that we as state senators should be looking at this issue from the standpoint of whether or not this is a good government bill. And believe me, and I hope you believe me, I'm not looking backward, Madam Chair. I'm looking forward with respect to this particular issue. And I believe very strongly that we should not be using public funds and public resources to either defeat or promote a matter once it is on the ballot. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Grace Kelleher from the Minnesota School Boards Association. I was sort of riding high after the legislative report, the legislative auditor, because on page 6, that first line says, in contrast to state officials, it's a relatively clear standard has been established for local governments in Minnesota, particularly school districts. So, you know, it's clear we know what we're supposed to do. We do a significant amount of training for elected school board members, and superintendents also have training. We are required by law to provide information about the referendum. So that isn't addressed in this bill. And so we have to provide information to the public. We do use school equipment to go out and do that, but it can't cross a line. Strictly informational, and for the most part, we do it. At times, board members will be asked, well, why did you vote yes so you'd put it in front of us? Well, here's why I voted yes on moving it forward to you, the voting public. So that's sort of the line they have to be extremely careful. And they know if they do it wrong, you could actually reverse the referendum. I mean, it can be really bad if this goes wrong for a local government. So I think a lot of board members are very conscientious. I wish I could say all for sure. There might be one or two, but certainly we really try to adhere to a higher standard and yet try to get our message out about what's on the ballot, what the voters are facing, so they make an informed decision. So thank you, Madam Chair.
And if I may, Madam Chair.
Sure, Senator Newman.
This is the first time that I've had an opportunity to speak to the School Boards Association, not through any fault of theirs. And I'm very amenable to opening up that discussion, very amenable to making whatever changes are necessary to address this issue, and hopefully put together a better bill.
Senator Newman, could you address this situation for me that I'm having trouble reconciling in my mind? When the photo ID question, when it was clear by the Republican-controlled legislature that Governor Dayton was going to veto the photo ID bill, or in fact he did veto, I believe, the first photo ID bill that the legislature passed, then the Republican-controlled legislature decided to put it to a ballot question. So I'll take myself, for example. I used public resources to educate constituents about why I thought that that was a bad policy for the state of Minnesota. So, for example, when people would call my office or send an email and say that they were either in support or opposition to a photo ID ballot question on the ballot, I would reply and give my opinion on the matter, which I'll be very frank and honest, it was against that constitutional amendment. Whether I provided that information at the point of the bill potentially becoming a law as enacted into statute, or whether that is a question before voters in the form of a constitutional amendment, what's the difference, in your opinion, to draw this bright line that you're doing in your proposed legislation? Because the issue before the voters is still the same, whether the state should have photo IDs for people when they go to vote.
Madam Chair, insofar as you and I are concerned as legislators, frankly, I don't think that we have access to the public funds to promote or defeat a ballot question once it has been passed by the legislature. And certainly you and I would have every right in the world to lobby for and against putting that measure on the ballot. What I'm really talking about would be, for instance, a governor or a lieutenant governor or someone who has access to public funds or public resources who would then go out within the state of Minnesota and use the public funds or public assets to promote the or defeat the ballot question. And that's what I think is improper. It's after the fact, after it's on the ballot.
But I guess I don't understand that distinction, Senator Newman, because if I'm using a public computer to respond to that constituent, I'm or my staff to convey my position to the public, to my constituents, I'm expending public funds for that purpose.
If, Madam Chair, under your scenario, I would agree with you. And under this bill, that would be improper. We have lots of rules that govern the use of our publicly provided computer. For instance, we can't solicit campaign funds. We cannot try and acquire lists of people to try and get donations from. So there's lots of restrictions on our use of these of this equipment right now. While it may be more convenient for you or I to use our Senate computer to respond to a constituent in order to influence their decision, under the terms of this bill, that would be improper, just like it's improper to solicit campaign funds with that computer.
No, and I understand that, but I guess I don't understand then the difference between what about that point between after the legislature passed a bill that was vetoed by Governor Dayton on photo ID. So there was a point after the legislature passed it, but before he vetoed it, that's very similar to the space as you're presenting in your bill. After a ballot question passes both bodies of the legislature, but before the public determines the outcome of the ballot question, what's that difference in terms of the use of public funds?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but I'm not tracking with you, and I'm trying.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that, for example, with the photo ID question, whether the impact on the photo ID bill that passed the legislature was first that the governor vetoed it, and then very similar language was presented to voters after the legislature passed a ballot question. So what's the difference between a ballot question, I guess what I'm saying, versus a law being passed by the legislature? Why have a prohibition on the use of public funds for a ballot question
rather than
anything else? I mean, what makes a ballot question so special that you have to restrict our First Amendment rights to speak about, in this case, a photo ID amendment, and why, in my case, I thought it was a bad idea versus anyone else's?
Well, I guess the way I would answer that question is there is nothing in this bill that would in any way restrict your First Amendment rights to speak against that ballot initiative. You and I, and we both know this, disagreed on that, and I spoke out in favor of it, and we have every right in the world to do that. That isn't the purpose of this bill. The purpose of this bill is to prohibit us from using public funds to support it. As legislators and as citizens, we have every right in the world to speak our mind and spend our money to promote or defeat that ballot question. So this bill isn't restricting your constitutional right of freedom of speech.
Well, Senator Newman, I would disagree. Just looking at the language on 1.4 and 1.5, it says no candidate or elected official shall spend or cause to be spent any public funds or use any other public resource with the purpose of promoting or defeating a ballot question. So if I, in essence, would use my staff or my Senate office resources to explain my position, I would be violating this proposal is the way I see it. furthermore, I think like it gets really sticky when you think about how our campaigns are partially publicly financed. So if we accept the campaign finance subsidy because we enter into an agreement with the campaign finance board, we are accepting public funds. So if on your campaign literature you wanted to say that, or I wanted to say that I was against the photo ID ballot question, I would be prohibited from saying that because it's using public funds. So I just am expressing some of my hesitation that I understand what you're trying to get at here, but I think that the language needs some further clarification and work.
And to that point, Madam Chair, I am not pretending that this would be the final language. I am open to a discussion. I do, however, hope that you understand the distinction on line 1.4 and 1.5, that what we're talking about is public funds and public money. We're not talking about your right or your freedom of speech. I mean, that is not the intent. And if that is the way you are interpreting the bill, then we would have to do some work on the bill, because you have, in your capacity as a state senator and as a citizen, every right in the world to express your opinion as to whether or not a bill is good or bad. I simply do not believe that we ought to be using public money and public resources to advance or try to stop the advancement of this ballot question.
Other discussion?
Mm-hmm.
Senator Kathleen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The way I read this is that this is about a ballot question. When we are passing bills or working on bills either in a committee or in between or anything like that, we're doing our legislative work. We couldn't do it without expressing our opinion as we are today, and also answering our citizen questions. However, even in our own legislative work, I believe it's 60 days after the end of session, the door closes. And in regards to, and maybe, matter of fact, maybe Ms. Stengel could give us that citation, but just recalling from my mind that there is that window of time after the legislative session when we do our legislative updates and reviews and stuff, but then after that stops. And we can't even use our email updates or do any of that in order to. Matter of fact, you have to think ahead to tell people that, because they're going to wonder why you're not doing it, and they need to know that there's a state law that doesn't allow us to do that. Now, in the House, that happens every 2 years. Because we're senators, we go over that 1 year that affects the House. So the issue there for me is senators have a four-year term, and we have a little different situation there that may need some work. But the other thing is that it is using, when it says public funds or other public resources with the purpose of promoting or defeating, but this is particular to a ballot question, we don't have a lot of them on our state level. These are far and few between that are actually that. But in our campaign side, I know that we are very partially funded with campaign dollars, I mean with some public dollars, but that has not been seen as the same definition of public funds and public resources. My understanding of that definition would be a state computer, state paper, state supplies, state paying for TV or things like that, versus that which comes out of our campaign. So that's how I kind of see this. But I think for us as senators, in that in-between election cycle, I don't know that this has that effect when you have a four-year term. And so I think that may need a little bit of work on that, where that maybe that 60-day has an effect. But then I'd be concerned about us being unable to perform our duties when we're not on the ballot. So a little work on that, I think, would be good. Those are just my comments. Maybe, Ms. Stengel, you can give me that statutory reference about that 60 days after the end of session.
Okay.
Are you still looking?
Yes,
okay, well, we can just get it another time.
While we're waiting for counsel, are there other people who want to comment on this Senate file? Other comments, Senator Newman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I have nothing further. I want to express my appreciation to you for allowing me come in and present this bill. I would request that you entertain the idea, and maybe we can work on it further in the future. But I do believe, whether or not this is the final version or not, I do believe that this is a worthwhile and important public issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would like to have the Secretary of State office, if they could come up, and since we're mentioning their name in here and the office's name, if they would care to comment. It would be good to hear from them.
Ms. Strother.
Good to see you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Julie Strother with the Office of the Secretary of State. Our office does not have an official position on this bill. The policy, particularly in Section 2 that's described, we would leave up to the legislature to decide. The office does question the need for the Secretary of State's office to be specifically called out separate from what's being imposed in Section 2, but that is really our only position on the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Stengel, or do you have, did you find that statute yet?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe the reference is in Chapter 10A, Section 10A.01, Subdivision 26, in the definition of non-campaign disbursement. And that talks about constituent services within after 60 days, sine die.
That's it. What's the reference again? What's it?
Section 10A.01, Subdivision 26.
And Madam Chair, I was going to respond to, I think that the reason why, and I think it is something for Senator Newman to consider the other state constitutional officers, you know, whether this is specific. But I think the Secretary of State office is different because they're like the referee of the game. And so we wouldn't want a referee taking a position for or against a team in the game, and especially while the game is being played. And so I see the chief election official in a uniquely different role. But again, the attorney general is one that sometimes is called upon to advise the Secretary of State as basically the lawyer for the constitutional officers. So I think the big thing is that those who are engaged in making rulings and things like that, it does make a difference to them as well. I think we as legislators, we're kind of in the business of campaigning for or against either ourselves or issues and declaring where we stand on the issues. It is essential to effective voter information and other things like that, and is very specific. But that's why I see this as important, to make sure that the referee of the whole election process has that standard. But I'm sure Senator Newman will take those comments into consideration and we can work further on it, because I think he does have a very valid point here and a very valid concept.
Seeing no other discussion then, thank you very much, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Oh, sorry.
Madam Chair.
Oh, sure. Last. Oh, sure. Oh, okay. Me last. Okay.
Sorry. Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
Just want to say for the record, that what would Newman do? It was nice to have him back in front of this committee.
I agree with that. Senator Ortman, Senate File 1205. Senator Ortman, welcome to the Election Subcommittee. We are getting a little bit tight on time, so I don't mean to rush you, but if you could just keep that in mind, but we're happy to consider Senate File 1205.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair and members, the informational hearing on this bill. The bill was presented really to put forward a bigger concept.
Could you move the microphone closer, please?
Oh, my, yes. Over the last several years, we've had primaries in September and August, and now we're talking about state primaries in June. And I thought that before we took a big step and made a big change, we should consider another alternative, which would be a March primary. I know from personal experience, knocking on doors in September, people don't know they're supposed to vote in September. Knocking on doors for an August primary, people didn't know that they were supposed to vote in an August primary. So any candidate that's running in a primary in June or August or September runs into that challenge of having to educate the voters that they actually have the right, the ability, and need to vote if they want to participate in the selection of candidates. So March primary is a good alternative. If you look what's been happening with voter turnout over recent decades, in 1966, the state had 833,530 voters in its primary. But by 2012, we had less than half that number, 359,000 actual voters. We went from a 39% voter participation rate to a 9.32% participation rate. In 2014, 2.7 million voters did not vote in our primary. I believe one of the best ways to address this issue is to engage the voters in early participation. Everyone knows that in the presidential years, election years, we have these giant primaries. The national, international media are covering these events. They're covering what's happening in states all across the country except Minnesota. Why except Minnesota? Because we are 38th in the process of selecting presidential candidates. By the time Minnesota gets around to participating in these primaries, it's already too late. Most of these decisions are already made. And Minnesotans have to choose. If they want to participate in the selection of presidential candidates, they have to load themselves up on buses and go to Iowa to participate. So I think we should consider this earlier primary when the entire nation is watching what's happening in elections. Attach our local primaries to our national primaries. Most voters get interested and inspired at the federal level, at the presidential level, and then they turn to their federal, state, and local races. So we could take advantage of that. This bill would move our primary from being 39th in the nation to the 18th in the nation. Members, I've heard people say that one of the reasons we shouldn't be doing this is that it might be difficult for legislative candidates to have to campaign during legislative session. And I just want to say that we often have endorsement conventions in May. Legislative candidates are already campaigning throughout the legislative session. And if you move the primary to June, I guarantee they will be campaigning throughout the session. The second criticism I've heard is that it may be difficult for our county's election officers. But I want to remind folks that the election officers and those that are working on the tax policies and tax collections out of our counties, they work for the voters. It is our primary duty as legislators looking at these issues to schedule these elections when we can encourage the most and highest number of voter turnout. And then finally, party officers. It's not our job here to put the party officers' interests ahead of the voters' interests. We need to schedule this primary at a time when we can encourage the highest voter turnout. One final thing, Madam Chair, in the interests of brevity here, a June primary would make us 34th. We still would not be meaningful in these presidential races. And as I traveled the state over the course of the last year, I heard from a lot of people that want to participate in these presidential races. If Hillary Clinton or Chris Christie or Jeb Bush, they want to run for president, they should stop in Minnesota. They should hear what Minnesotans have to say about presidential politics and about the state of our nation and our future. Members, I think that if we move the June primary, or our primary to June, unless it increases voter participation, it isn't an improvement over August or September. So I ask you to please consider the timing of this primary to involve as many Minnesota voters as possible. I think that it will serve our state better because it really then ensures greater authority when there's greater participation on the part of our voters.
Senator Ortman, could you please explain what this would do to our caucus system in Minnesota?
Sure. Members, the caucuses can still take place. There's plenty of time for our caucuses to convene in January and reach a state convention before this primary election. That process will have to be a little bit shortened, but it certainly can be done. And I would remind members that our political parties are associations. They aren't a function of the government. They can manage their own processes and should manage their processes to reach a convention in time for these primaries. It's done in, as I said, 37 other states. We can make adjustments in our process to accommodate for greater voter participation.
And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that right now the political parties agree, the parties themselves, the chairs, agree to when the date of that caucus is going to be. And I know, like, for the upcoming one, I believe it's in March. So this, I assume that if we would pass this, they would have to back it up earlier into February or before then.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm convinced that if the legislature were to pass a March primary date, the chairs of our parties would accommodate that and would make sure that those caucuses were convened in time for a convention primary to the prior to the primary.
And Senator Ortman, there's new language in here about the filing fee and the candidates who are filing for office and stuff, and the selection of delegates. Do you care to comment on that?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. The bill includes a filing of an affidavit for presidential candidates. Right now, we don't have that process in Minnesota. They are exempt. Another reason why we can tell that these elections truly are not as meaningful as they could be. We don't even have presidential candidates filing for office here in the state of Minnesota. This would require that affidavit. It would require 1,000 petition signatures and a filing fee. So it's processed to make sure they get on the ballot and we can identify who those candidates are that will be presented at the primary.
And the delegates, the selection of delegates?
Yes, Madam Chair. One of the great frustrations coming out of the last presidential election was the fact that Rick Santorum won the straw polls here in the state of Minnesota. But when our delegates went to our national convention, he didn't receive even one vote. All of the delegates voted for Romney and Paul, if you recall that. So what this language would do is present the requirement that if you're elected as a delegate, you have to represent your caucus at that next convention and the outcome of that caucus on at least the first ballot for that candidate.
Senator Ortman, is that you feel that that's necessary to put into state law, though? That's not something that the parties could just handle on their own?
Well, you know, I leave that to the experience and wisdom of this committee. But I think that when we have folks elected to represent the caucus attendees' point of view, it is a disruption of that process, and it can be seen as a loss of confidence and trust in that process. So I leave it to you to consider that. I put that language in here so you would consider it and give it your best determination about whether or not we should be binding our delegates at least for that first ballot at the succeeding convention.
Questions for Senator Ortman? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Interesting. I was looking forward to the presentation today, Senator Ortman, to just kind of see your comments and how that all worked. I did make a comment earlier, and this had to do with the primary proposal for June, and that was that the purpose of a primary is to nominate within a political party, or in the case of a nonpartisan, to narrow the choices down. And so it has a very specific purpose. Sometimes we use the word election. It's not an election. People don't take office. They do take a position on the ballot, which they are nominated to, and the context of the state law uses that word nomination. So I always just want to, you know, it's a successful thing in the sense that the party has accomplished what the purpose of the primary was for partisan offices, and that they have narrowed their choice to one. And I think that sometimes I find that the subset of people in regards to a political party caring about that and being involved in that is not necessarily the whole pool of the voters. It is a subset of them for either political party. And so it's kind of a different dynamic and a different function. And I had said that on the other one, and it's just kind of one of those things that I wanted to say here as well. But that doesn't detract from your overall concept of in the month of March. I think the thing that I find, I've always kind of struggled with this, is pushing things back before Christmas and into November that I find is more of my hurdle. I know what you're saying about the January thing, but in fact, a lot of work's going to have to be done to get ready even for that January time. So that's probably the harder thing that I have found conceptually to deal with. If it could just be March without those backward pressures, I think it'd be more tempting. I don't know if folks know, but we did have a presidential primary one year in March, and it was cost $3 million to do that. And in addition to that, we had a September primary that year. And so it was very interesting to kind of go through that March primary process. I don't know that they had any bigger turnout in that particular thing, but it was just once. And so the first time, you know, I don't know if it's and primary nomination events anyway, the heat of the contest, there's so many variations as to what's going on that it's hard to judge them from one year to another, unlike presidential, gubernatorial, and so on. But we did have that at one time. So I think maybe for the future I'll go look up a little history and see if we can glean some information for that particular one. But thank you for bringing it forward as an idea for discussion. I think it's good to, like you said, at this time we are talking about it, so let's get options on the table, and I appreciate that.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment. I don't think that a March primary really moves the election up any. It may require a little additional planning or earlier planning for the parties, but the candidates are already running, and they're already planning. I don't think that it really extends the election season, but for some of that party planning. And I would just comment about the nomination process. Our primaries have become that for sure, but I think that's unfortunate. We had voter turnout in earlier years, and you can see the handout that we gave you with all of the different voter turnout going back well before there were partisan legislative elections prior to 1973. It wasn't about nominating candidates prior to that. And so I'd like to have that bigger picture conversation and say, what should these primaries look like? I certainly wouldn't want to see two primaries in one year like they had in the year that you spoke about, Senator Kiffmeyer. But I think if we're going to have the conversation, as Senator Carlson has asked, and I know Representative Dowd is looking for a June primary, let's look at what we're trying to accomplish by setting that primary in June. And you're the committee that will do that. That's why I wanted to come and present this bill and say, let's talk about encouraging voter participation, making those votes meaningful, participating in the presidential primaries as well.
Well, Senator Ortman, I understand that your comments have been focused a lot on the presidential, and I'm sure a lot of us would agree that that's a good thing. But you do, of course, realize that when you back up the primary, it does extend the election season. Maybe not for the purposes of that the public would generally notice, but it does back up when you have to, when you file, when the nominating petitions are due. Your bill outlines that the period for signing nominating petitions begins 16 weeks before the primary and ends 10 weeks before the primary, and the filing period then is backed up. So it does impact, you know, other. It certainly impacts all other races that are held, and just the process of filing for office and when our campaign reports are due, all of those things do get backed up. So that's what we were referencing when we were talking about the campaign season does get longer.
Madam Chair, I agree with that, and those are the practicalities of running. I'm just saying that in reality, candidates are already raising money. They're already starting to prepare their organizations, hire people. It creates a longer general election season, to be sure, than we currently have. That preparatory season is much longer now. And I would say the voters would be benefited by having a longer general election season, that portion of the election. But I understand your point that we are actually physically backing up dates. It's a balance here.
And Ms. Kelleher pointed out earlier on Senator Carlson's bill that in some rural parts of the state, for instance, it's hard to find candidates to run for office, in her case for school board. So when you back up the filing dates or the primary dates, you're impacting the candidates who, you know, trying to find candidates to run for office, because not only does the filing period open earlier, but it closes earlier as well. So thank you very much for Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment to the point of the sheet that you put out. That is really, really relevant to see that when they did not have a political party designation and the turnout, but it's a little unfair to use that in a situation of where you're going from no political party designation to a political party designation. So you're kind of comparing two different things that are going on. You're very, very different kinds of things. And it only begs the question more, you know, should we go back to that? It introduces another, if you want to throw out real ideas and things, that we really take a look at that. That was a factor that contributed to that, because it was not a political party narrowing their choice to one, such as what we had after 1973. That's all, just in a comparison thing.
Senator Carlson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Orban, I'm curious about one of those points that you made about the pledging of a delegate from either the primary or from the straw poll to the convention. Is how do other states do that? I guess what I'm thinking of is that, first of all, I guess I tend to agree that the parties should be able to handle that themselves, but also there's such a distance, a time distance in there, and that would it, you know, is it important to try to bind an elector? And also, what do other states do?
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, the language, I believe, in here also defers to the party's platforms, so that if they have some other process that would be in contravention here, then their process would actually be the one that would be applied here. So if there's no other process, then those delegates would be bound for at least one vote. You know, I think they do it differently by state. Some do, some don't bind their delegates. Some do by party platform, some don't by party platform. So it really varies. But I thought that there was, what I heard was a loss of confidence in the process when people voted overwhelmingly for one candidate and never saw that candidate be represented at the following convention. And so just listening to that, I think it's an idea to put back on the table and say, if we are going to create statutes that further a party process and nominating process, like you all believe the primary election is, then maybe we should make sure that we're meeting the needs of everybody. And if they're invited to participate in the process, then their expectations should also be met. I, for one, think that the state statute shouldn't be used to further the party process. I think the party process can do that on its own. They don't need state statutes in order to do that. But I'm just one legislator.
Thank you.
Are there other people who wish to testify on this bill? Thank you very much, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Kiffmeyer, Senate File 1711. The Environment Committee is coming back into this room at 4 o'clock, so we'll see how far we can get, Senator Kiffmeyer, but if we need to extend it to another day, we can.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm presenting Senate File 1711 today, and that is setting a uniform date for local referenda. And so it sets the uniform date related to and specifically to the November date. In regards to that, Sections 1 and 2 also talk about increasing general education revenue, holding that referenda on the first Monday in November in any year. And Section 2 deletes the authority to hold them in a different time or by mail. Section 3 and 4 just go on to the question to be held, and it just states it again. But overall, in its essence and its summary, this is just requiring that any referendums be held on the first Tuesday of March, as would any of our other general election dates. The goal here is to save money. It's expensive to hold an election. And so by putting all of our resources into one election day in November, which is where you also have the maximum number of people participating in the process, and this is an election when final decisions are made, whether it's a candidate that take office or the accepting of expending, in many cases, a lot of money, millions of dollars. And so it would save money for the locals by holding it on the first Tuesday in November with any other election day, so you can pool those resources. And you also have a larger number of people casting ballots in regards to very important issues. And so, Madam Chair, in the essence here, this is what this bill is about here today. And I'll be glad to answer any questions. I have met with AMC, MICA, and the League of Minnesota Cities. The League of Minnesota Cities does not have a position for or against it, but they did share that they were concerned about some sort of event that could occur for them, but current law 205.105 does make a reference to inclement weather and that kind of issue, and however that has been used rarely indeed. It takes a lot to cancel an election because you have no guarantee here in Minnesota that some other event might not happen the next time. So in general, the philosophy has been that we proceed with the election unless it is something really catastrophic. But that is what has been shared with me with some concerns in regards to that issue. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll be glad to answer questions or allow you to, if there are testifiers.
Senator Kiffmeyer, on page 14, it talks specifically about the city of Cannon Falls and Redwood Falls. What is that about? It's lines 1431 to 1433.
That is interesting, Madam Chair.
I'm Senator Kiffmeyer. Counsel said she can explain.
Okay, that's right.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I wondered that same thing when I was looking through the bill. And it just so happens that when you look in Chapter 469, which is an economic development chapter, there are lots of specific port authorities, economic development authorities, housing redevelopment authorities, and those sorts of things that are named specifically. And this is the only one that happened to talk about an election held by one of those two port authorities. So presumably if there were other entities within that chapter that also had similar language, it would have changed it. So essentially it's just trying to keep the date uniform for all of the entities, and it just so happens that this one happened to have a specific name for the specific cities.
Okay. We have some people signed up to testify. First, Grace Kelleher. And maybe Mr. Kroonquist, you could come up as well. That's your next.
Good Welcome. Afternoon, Madam Chairman and members. Grace Kelleher with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And we have a lot of concern with this bill going forward. I'm going to start out and tell you that local governments are different, and one big way we're different is that we must go to the people and ask for their support on capital facilities. We cannot raise a levy on our own. We have to go there. So first of all, we're different than the other groups just based on that. We also in Minnesota have huge facility disparities. And we tried, I served on a working group that tried to address that, and there is a lot of investment going on there. But we have needs in school districts that need to be met. For instance, if we'd lose a boiler and we'd have to wait, you know, if it went out in December, we'd have to wait till the next November before we're allowed to do it. If a roof leaks, if there's all kinds of different areas facility-wise that could come forward. We think at least the November ballot could at some point become almost unmanageable. And I keep thinking the school referendums would go below the judges. And if you look at the cutoff rate as you go down the list, gets more and more interesting. So I asked my staff, because I was curious, Senator Kiffmeyer sort of mentioned it, about what would be the difference if between running a capital project on Election Day versus running it any other time during the year in the same year. So in 2014, on the general election, school districts ran 16 capital projects and six failed. So it's about a 73% passage rate. That was the off-general election. So it's 23. On the general election day, we ran 25 capital projects. Eight failed for a 75% passage rate. So we actually did better on election day. In 2013, there were no off elections for capital projects. And on election day, 23 passed, three failed for an 88% passage rate. And in 2012, off general elections for capital projects, five passed, four failed for a 55% rate. And on general election day, nine passed, eight failed for a 53%. So, Madam Chairman, they're very comparable within the year about how voters approach that. I can guarantee by forcing us to wait almost a whole building cycle that there will be costs involved, so you'll have escalating capital costs as you wait for that November election to come in. Now, we're not talking operating levy. We're talking buildings and grounds and things that might be very important to fix quickly where we have no flexibility except that one day in the calendar to run referendums. And last but not least, facilities in the state of Minnesota are really in a precarious position. The commissioner was wise enough to put together a working group to tackle it, but this really, really would hurt our present process. So I want to encourage the committee to not go forward with this bill. Give us an opportunity to right some of the problems like equalization and alternative facilities that really make some districts have it really a lot easier than others. So, Madam Chairman, give us a time to get our statute in order, and certainly this is not the right time to do this unless you want kids to sit in buildings that are in severe need of repair or overcrowding. So with that, I'll be happy to answer
Ms. Kelleher, just to clarify, so for example, if a school has a major water main break and there is an emergency, unlike a local unit of government such as a city or a county, if you needed to expend funds to fix that or to replace some major piece of equipment, could you do that on your own if you did not have the current capacity to do it within your existing budget funds, or would you have to go out and ask voters to do that?
Madam Chairman and members, with a water main break, we'd have to find the money. A little bit like how you do it at home, we'd have to look under all the cushions in the couch hopefully we can find something, postpone something, with the option then to go out and ask our voters at some point, do they want to take care of this issue? Or do they want to lose, you know, middle school band? And you can just start to look at the cuts, depending on how large the project would need to be done. And the community is a part of what school districts look like. Because we are forced to go to the voters and ask for their support, communities understand school district budgets by far much better than any other local government. I mean, think about it. We're the only place taxpayers can say, no, I don't want my taxes to go up. So in a way, this is almost a doubling of the burden. Not only can they say, no, I don't want my taxes to go up, but they have one day where they could focus on to do that, and we'd have to wait a whole nother cycle before we get an opportunity to come forward.
Thank you. Mr. Kroonquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and appreciate the opportunity to offer a few comments. We do have some concerns, similar, I guess some of them similar to what Ms. Kelleher just represented. Really, this for school districts, what this is really impacting is the bond and capital projects referenda. For all practical purposes, all of our operating referenda are already held on November. The only exceptions in law were if you're a school district in statutory operating debt or by mail, and this would actually remove the by mail option as well. When a school district needs to build a new building or an addition, basically, what the first decision point is, when does that building need to come online, right? When do we need it? And then from there, the district kind of backs up. You talk to your construction managers, your engineers, your architects, and you set your timeline. And so that really, more than anything, actually right now drives that timing of when you would need to hold the election. But if there is some flexibility within that, then what school districts want to do is to try to time it when they can save money for the taxpayers. So they will look at things like, what are the interest rates right now? What, you know, what does the construction look like? How busy are the construction companies? Is the demand real high? Which means the prices will be a lot higher. And so if they have some flexibility around that timing, then they're actually able to hopefully lower the cost of the overall project and save their taxpayers money. And as Ms. Kelleher pointed out, if we were stuck with one election day, we lose all that flexibility. Then just a real more practical and political reality for school districts. And as you know, generally our school election questions are at the end of the ballot. So oftentimes we have quite an undervote, meaning people just leave that question blank because they get to it and they didn't know about it. And you think about it, that's probably not real surprising because the other elections that are on the ballot are much higher profile. Tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars are spent on those. In fact, as you know, with this last election, we had house races in Minnesota where almost $1 million were spent. And so you have your little school district trying to run an election and trying to inform the voters about what's going on, what's the impact for them, what does it cost, what does it mean to your schools, your kids, your staff. And they have a real hard time getting through and getting that message out. Whereas if it's a bond election that's held on a different date, then there's ample opportunity. It's very clear what that election is about. And constituents are going to get the information because we are required by law to get it to them. We have to do a first-class mailing to make sure that everyone knows what's on the ballot, what the cost impact is. So the information does get out to the constituents, and they actually have, a better understanding of what that election actually means. So I'll leave it at that, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Mr. Kroonquist. Ms. Dozeland.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozeland, and I represent the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. And MASBO is, you know, for lack of a better term, they're the bean counters in school districts. And they're the ones that are digging through the couch cushions, looking behind the couches, and digging in every little square corner of the school district that they can for resources to fund K-12 needs, including school district buildings. We have concerns about this proposal, many of which have been echoed by Grace Kelleher and Scott Kronquist. But I would contend that I don't think that this proposal would save school districts money. School districts are very thoughtful when they go through their process about determining if they need to have a capital projects referendum or a bond referendum. My school district, 196, is going through a process right now to consider an election, and they are doing focus groups, surveys, and there are a number of things that they need to do in order to communicate to their voters about these bond referendums. And requiring the elections to be held on general elections could possibly result in increased costs, not just because of delays for construction projects, but just in the rates that they're able to get depending on the time of year that the election is held. So, again, I just would echo the concerns, and we would have real challenges if this proposal were to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate File 1711? Anything further to add, Senator Kiffmeyer?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought it was very interesting to hear the comparison between a different day and on November, that the results were fairly comparable as far as the outcome. And that is what I found interesting, that you can have that. And so the result issue or the outcome issue is less of a factor. What I found that I have heard here more than anything is that two things. One, if it's held on another date, the voters will pay more attention. In fact, I've not found that to be true. Most of the time when you have a referendum going on separate from any other election day, sometimes these are held on a Monday, on a Wednesday, on a Thursday. They have different hours. They have a combined polling place, just one polling place. That is many, many, many miles distant for some people. They're used to having a certain polling place on the November general election. And so they're aware of that. I believe they're also paying more attention on the November election day because it's in their mind. They're paying attention, and they're noticing and looking at things and that information. This is the day to pay attention with that. How many other times have I done phoning or talked to people about getting out to vote when there is a school referendum election other than in connection with the November? They've just lost it because they're just not attuned to the fact that this is an election time like they are in November. In regards to some of these facilities, I've sat through many school board meetings and have read their budgets, and nearly all of them have capital needs, repairs. I mean, any good school district is going to know that at some point those sorts of things can happen, and that they have those things. And some of the things are bigger, without question. But in general, their plant management and their maintenance folks are keeping them attuned to where that is. And the other thing is that the school boards themselves, if they're going to do a building, they're working on this for years, thinking ahead of it. This is not a, we thought about it in a short period of time, and then you're going to go out for a referendum. These school boards are talking about the needs for buildings, what they're going to do, temporary shelters. They're going through those things. If there is something like a roof issue, they have insurance to cover that. And so some of that is just like us in our home, we have insurance to cover that. So those are my responses to some of their issues here. And so I don't know that I agree that it's going to increase those costs, and I think the savings is very real of having their elections happen in concert with that. And it's really especially more fair to the voters. It is heavily done for these school elections on these referendums that they will take a school district that normally might have 10, 12, 16, 20 polling places and bring that down to one or two. And those change from what they're used to, and that also hinders their participation. So those are my comments, Madam Chair. I know this is an informational hearing at any rate, but I would still urge support.
Well, thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer, for your presentation, and to the testifiers. I think that personally I fall on the side of believing that our locally elected school board members can make the decisions that are in the best interests of the constituents that they represent. And as we heard, many of them choose to have the elections on the traditional election day, but others choose to have it at other points of the year for other issues that were outlined. But regardless, I appreciate the conversation and thank you for bringing the bill forward. Senator Carlson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Kiffmeyer, you mentioned having referendums on odd days, different times of the year, and all that. And because this is an informational hearing, I'd like to have you take a look at this later on. This is a handbill from the referendum for my school. And the election was held on Wednesday, June 27th, 1951, from 10 o'clock a.m. to 9 o'clock p.m. at the school. And, you know, this was, I found this in my mother's things after she passed away. This was the bond election, or the bond referendum, that built the school that I attended in first grade. So, and I'm really glad that they worked hard to get that passed. And personally, I don't really care what day or time that they did it, but it was passed, and it made a huge difference to our community.
And Madam Chair, to that point, if you will note that, as Ms. Kelleher said, the outcome of those things was very comparable, whether you did it with the November or elsewhere. So it could have happened, indeed, on November as well.
Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, to this point, I can tell you this year we had a referendum that I was purposing to go to in February, which I was not pleased on the date because I trying to remember it and completely forgot it because life was just so busy and it wasn't where I normally is, which is around the corner from my house. It frustrated me so much that they did it on a day that I purposed to vote, and it just really bothers me. So I think it's a shame that they do that. They are accountable to that, and I will hold them accountable. And I let some know that I was very frustrated that they wouldn't do it on a day that I would normally do it. And they gave me an excuse, but I did feel uncomfortable with the excuse. So I think
Senator
that would be
Hall,
a good bill.
I didn't mean to cut you off there,
sure,
but maybe
right.
If you'd support early voting, then these school districts would have multiple
I
days
knew
that they
there
could
was something wrong there.
Choose to hold the election.
Madam Chair, they do have absentee voting.
That's right.
And couldn't hold that back, could you?
No.
And Madam Chair, Senator Hall, they passed it even without your vote.
Yeah, I understand that.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Mm-hmm. And with that, the committee is adjourned.
Good to see you. Yeah. We knew you were going to...